Okay, everyone, we're going to start now. If everyone can be quiet. Thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Daniel Elephant.
And I am Rachel Glennick.
One of the most important goals of the Medical Ethics Society is to educate our community about contemporary medical ethics issues. Additionally, we try to stimulate creative discussions surrounding those issues. Tonight, we fulfill both of those goals with the event called Executing the Hippocratic Oath. The most serious punishment that any court system administers is the death penalty, the decision that one's actions are criminal enough that he no longer bears the right to live. So now the questions are, should we treat him any less morally because of those actions, whether it be his viewing his life itself or the act of ending it? Should that be any less morally dealt with? What methods should be used to end his life? Should a medical technician be the only one who's trusted enough to ensure that protocols are met in ending that life, when essentially the medical technician's job is to save lives? These questions are all in the realm of secular ethics. Now let us enter Jewish ethics. And back in the day when the Jewish halachic court system functioned, it also administered the death penalty when the law required it. What were some of the ethical considerations of Jewish law? And how would Jewish law view a doctor who chooses to participate in the death penalty today in terms of what's required of him or allowed for him to do by law? All of these questions will be answered tonight by the experts sitting here before you.
Dr. Deborah Denno is a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law. She received her BA from University of Virginia, her MA from University of Toronto, her PhD in criminology, and her JD from the University of Pennsylvania. At Fordham Law School, she primarily teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, torts, and various seminars on advanced criminal law topics. Professor Denno has published on a broad range of topics relating to criminal law, criminal procedure, social sciences and the law, and the death penalty, including the constitutionality of execution methods. In the Supreme Court's recent execution methods decision, the Supreme Court cited four different articles by Professor Denno. She is one of the leading experts on lethal injection in the United States. Our second speaker tonight is Rabbi Dr. Glatt. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt is the assistant rabbi at Congregation Anshei Chesed in Hewlett, New York, as well as at the Young Israel of Woodmere in Woodmere, New York. Rabbi Dr. Glatt is currently president and CEO of St. Joseph Hospital in Bethpage, New York, and is also a professor of clinical medicine at New York Medical College. He earned his BA from Yeshiva University, where he was class valedictorian, and received his medical degree from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. After completing his internship, residency, and chief residency in internal medicine, he went on to complete his fellowship in infectious diseases. Rabbi Dr. Glatt has authored over 200 scientific journal articles and presented worldwide on a variety of Jewish as well as medical subjects. It is my pleasure to now welcome our first speaker, Dr. Denno, to the podium.
I wanted to thank the organizers of this panel for inviting me to such a thoughtfully planned event, and I also really appreciate having the opportunity to get a perhaps what's going to be a very different kind of perspective on a topic that I've dealt with for quite a long time. So from that perspective, I really look forward to learning a lot tonight. So onto the topic here for tonight concerning whether physicians should participate in lethal injection executions. And I'm going to start with the legal aspects first. On January 7, 2008, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments in Bays v. Rees, a Kentucky case that was brought by two death row inmates who were challenging the constitutionality of that particular state's lethal injection procedure. In particular, these inmates were questioning the three chemicals that are used in a lethal injection in Kentucky, as well as what standards courts should apply to assess whether the lethal injection violates the Eighth Amendment's Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. Bays turned out to be a critically important death penalty case. Lethal injection is the single leading method of execution in all 34 death penalty states in this country. As a result, the Bayes challenge to the method prompted a de facto national moratorium on all executions in this country, and these kind of moratoria are extremely rare. From September 2007 to May 2008, there were no executions at all in this country entirely because of the Bayes case. But once executions started up again, the court's hopes were dashed that the problems with lethal injection would be quelled. And the matter of physician participation has been front and center in these kinds of death penalty debates. For the last 30 years, attorneys have challenged lethal injection's constitutionality on a variety of grounds, ranging from the selection and qualifications of the execution team to the particular formula that's used in lethal injections. I jumped a bit. The typical formula consists of three chemicals: sodium thiopental, a common anesthetic for surgery used to cause unconsciousness; pancuronium bromide, a total muscle relaxant that stops breathing by paralyzing the diaphragm and lungs; and potassium chloride, a toxin that induces cardiac arrest and permanently stops the inmate's heartbeat. A primary concern in lethal injection execution is whether the first drug, the sodium thiopental, successfully causes the inmate to lose consciousness. There's agreement among all different kinds of experts that if the sodium thiopental, this first drug, is ineffective, it would be extraordinarily painful to inject the second and third drugs into a conscious person. Because of its paralytic effects, the second drug, pancuronium bromide, would mask indication that the inmate is conscious and in excruciating pain from feelings of suffocation from the pancuronium, as well as the intense burning that the potassium chloride can cause. But another key question underlying Bayes is this one: how did all death penalty states in this country ever come to adopt such a shockingly problematic method of execution? And history provides much of the answer. Looking back, there's as little excuse for lethal injection's adoption as there is for its perpetuation. Repeatedly, lethal injection's deficiencies were documented over the decades, but were simply ignored. The circumstance with lethal injection is all the more problematic given that over more than a century, lethal injection followed a steady stream of execution methods that were all highly deficient, starting with electrocution in 1890, then on to lethal gas in 1921, and then to lethal injection in 1977. Eventually, the law turned to medicine to rescue the death penalty, and I just wanted to add that all these methods that you see before you are still constitutional in the United States, and they're still applied every once in a while, including firing squad. History shows, for example, that as early as 1888, New York State considered using cyanide injection as a potential method of execution, but a state commission dismissed injection because of the medical profession's belief at that time that the public would then begin to link the practice of medicine with death. Of course, this concern about lethal injection exists to the present day. In 1953, Great Britain's Royal Commission on Capital Punishment also dismissed a form of lethal injection, concluding after a five-year study that injection was no better than hanging, Great Britain's long-standing method. But critical to the Royal Commission's investigation of lethal injection, however, was the substantial weight the commission gave to medical expertise. The commission solicited input from members of two of the country's most established medical organizations, as well as from medical prison officials and people who are working within the prison. In 1976, the United States examined the lethal injection issue after the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty following a four-year moratorium at that time. Remarkably, during this examination, none of the medical opinion evidence gathered on lethal injection, either from the New York or the British commissions that I just mentioned to you, was addressed in legislative discussions or debates. Seemingly oblivious to prior concerns, American lawmakers emphasized that lethal injection appeared more humane and visually acceptable relative to other methods. It was also far cheaper. In May of 1977, Oklahoma became the first state to adopt lethal injection. Contrary to the thorough and deliberative approaches that were taken by the New York and British commissions, however, accounts suggest that one person, and that was J. Chapman, the state's medical examiner, was the method's primary creator. While lawmakers had contacted the president of the Oklahoma Medical Association to get his advice and input on this procedure, the Oklahoma Medical Association's president insisted that he didn't want to become entrenched at all in this venture because licensed physicians could not participate in executions. In subsequent years, American medical societies continuously would echo this stance, balking at any official involvement in lethal injection. Yet lawmakers would proceed with their decision making regardless. And with medical societies out of the picture in 1977 and not wanting to get involved, lawmakers consulted with J. Chapman, this one doctor. From the start, however, Chapman, who I interviewed repeatedly, still alive and well and living in California, was upfront about his glaring lack of expertise, even to create this method of execution. Indeed, when initially contacted by lawmakers, even back in 1977, Chapman's first response that he was an expert in dead bodies, but not an expert in getting them that way. So, regardless, with virtually no scientific study or medical expertise, Chapman quickly concocted this three-drug formula that Kentucky and other lethal injection states use now, and I mean last week. So within days after the Oklahoma legislature adopted Chapman's method, Chapman warned about lethal injection's hazards. In the Daily Oklahoman, for example, he noted that, quote, if the death-dealing drug is not administered properly, the convict may die and be subject to severe muscle pain. News articles from the late 1970s also made clear the tentative status of Oklahoma's protocol. A 1979 Daily Oklahoman article, for example, emphasized that, quote, officials with the State Department of Corrections say it may be years, if ever, before they're required to carry out the mandates of the 1977 legislature. The article also noted that officials feel that if and when they have to use lethal injection, new and better drugs would be available. End of quote. Such statements suggest officials had minimal confidence in the effectiveness of the chemicals that Chapman introduced and even anticipated that they may never be applied. Regardless, lethal injection was indeed enacted in 1977. In 1982, there was the first lethal injection execution that took place in the state of Texas. And even before 1982, even before lethal injection had ever been used in this country, five states had already adopted it. After 1982, state after state adopted the method. Yet with the benefits of hindsight, states did never medically improved upon the method that consistently resulted in documented debacles from the very first execution, which was a debacle. There was documentation. States never changed anything. As the trial court in Bays v. Reese concluded in 2005, there's scant, quote, and I'm quoting now, there's scant evidence that ensuing state's adoption of lethal injection was supported by any additional medical or scientific studies. Rather, the various states simply fell in line, relying solely on Oklahoma's protocol. Indeed, J. Chapman remains shocked by reports that lethal injection generally is performed by individuals with little to no familiarity with the procedure. In 2006, interview with CNN, Chapman stated bluntly that he, quote, never knew we would have complete idiots injecting these drugs, which we seem to have, end of quote. He also conceded that, quote, there are many problems that can arise given the concerns people are raising with the protocol. It should be reexamined. Now there are other agents that work much faster and easier, end of quote. But incredibly, Chapman would be followed in time with a strikingly uneducated marketer of lethal injection machines, that being Fred Lucher. Until 1990, Lucher was the producer of most of this country's execution machinery, which he created in his basement in Boston. Yet Lucher's unrelenting and vocal denial of the Holocaust garnered him a controversial spotlight in the media. As a result, groups discovered Lucher was not the, quote, engineer that he claimed he was, but rather was only the holder of a bachelor's degree in history. In 1994, I interviewed Lucher extensively. He told me the revelation destroyed his business. No warden would go near him publicly, although privately, he said wardens still called him a lot for advice. Since the time of my interview with Lucher, Lucher's unique role in the execution business made him the subject of a documentary by noted director Errol Morris, as well as the focus of a book and numerous articles. The view Lucher presented was that there was simply no one else willing or available to do the job of executions. That's why he said in interviews and said to me privately, wardens were still calling him. They had no one else to turn to. Yet, as it turns out, that view was not entirely accurate, at least not with respect to lethal injection executions, nor with respect to physicians. In their 2001 article, Physicians' Willingness to Participate in the Process of Lethal Injection and Capital Punishment, Neil Farmer and Farber and his colleagues determined that 19% of the physicians they surveyed would be willing to inject an inmate with lethal injection drugs in an execution. Or I said 19% would be willing to inject an inmate with lethal injection drugs in an execution. Even more would be willing to engage in the tasks leading up to an execution. That is, weighing the drugs and putting them in the syringe, and some even said they would go so far as doing the actual injection. Last month, in 2008, in an anonymous poll conducted by the New England Journal of Medicine, 24% of respondents, the journal's readers, believe that healthcare professionals should participate in lethal injections. As for whether the respondent himself or herself would participate, 15% of healthcare professionals said yes, and 2% of non-healthcare professionals said yes. Of course, the majority of respondents were against participation. But what it's important to note is, despite the fuss over lethal injection, since Farber's 2001 study, a solid percentage of healthcare professionals are for participation. Since 1977, some physicians have held key levels of involvement in injections, although the nature and extent of this participation was not fully realized until recently, and that's because all these injections are for the most part conducted in secret. It's very difficult to get any information at all. So that's why the full extent of their participation wasn't fully known. Such participation has ranged from the original creation of the original creation of lethal injection, that being Jay Chapman, to evidence of a more direct physician presence in executions, which includes, for example, the involvement of physician Ralph Gray, the medical chair of the Texas prison system, who was involved in this country's very first lethal injection in 1982. And he was sitting there actually when executioners were actually having a problem with that execution. New evidence in 2006 and 2007 again reveals a surprising degree of physician participation in lethal injection executions. For example, Missouri's Dr. Doe, who began performing lethal injections in the mid-1990s, is a particularly disturbing case that illustrates the potential for executioner incompetence even among physicians. Dr. Doe was the supervising execution doctor for the Missouri Department of Corrections. Yet he was hired with a troublesome record documenting more than 20 malpractice suits against him and revoked privileges at two hospitals. In 2006, Dr. Doe was deposed by attorneys representing a death row inmate who was challenging the method of lethal injection in Missouri. The deposition revealed that Dr. Doe, who had supervised 54 of the state's lethal injection executions, was faulty beyond the pale. Not only was he unaware of Missouri's written execution procedures, his testimony revealed that he totally improvised while mixing lethal injection drugs. Indeed, he attributed his proven mistakes and quote inconsistencies, and those are his words, mistakes and inconsistencies, in preparing the drugs to his lifelong challenges with dyslexia. The U.S. District Court for the Western District of Missouri subsequently banned Dr. Doe from participating in future executions. But don't feel sorry for Dr. Doe. A recent L.A. Times article revealed that after Dr. Doe was banned for participating in lethal injections in Missouri, he was promptly hired by the federal government to perform its lethal injection executions. So as far as we know, Dr. Doe is still employed with the federal government in this capacity. Not to be discounted are the handful of anonymous physicians and a nurse who were interviewed as part of Harvard Medical School Professor Atul Gawande's 2006 article, Why Physicians Participate in Executions. The compelling stories of these medical professionals recounted in Gawande's article highlight the differing nature of how some physicians view the lethal injection scene. According to one anonymous doctor, Dr. C, I'll call, for example, the state in which he was a citizen needed his services to perform executions humanely, and he felt obligated to be available. Dr. Carlo Musso, a Georgia physician, who acknowledged that he has maintained a 3-year presence in that state's lethal injection executions, echoed the perspective that doctors were not the ones deciding who gets the death penalty. Quote, "This is an end-of-life issue, just as with any other terminal disease. It just happens that it involves a legal process instead of a medical process," end of quote. Those are Dr. Musso's words. In turn, all the professionals interviewed for Dr. Gawande's article could agree with Dr. B. And this is Dr. B's quote. Quote, "If the doctors or nurses are removed, I don't think lethal injections could be competently or predictably done," end of quote. This controversy and these perspectives becomes particularly pronounced in one example, that being the state of North Carolina. It's just one of many I could give. But in 2007, a North Carolina physician admitted that he had attended at least 2 of the state's most recent executions, but for ethical reasons failed to monitor the inmate's consciousness both times, contrary to federal judges' expectations. That was an obligation in the lethal injection procedure in North Carolina, was to monitor an inmate's consciousness. Following this controversial discovery, inmates challenged the state's protocol after the North Carolina Medical Board issued its position statement precluding participation in a lethal injection execution by a physician. An administrative law judge, however, held that state officials did not err in including physician involvement in the state's protocol, a position that a North Carolina Superior Court judge has recently reinforced with the following reasoning. Angel of mercy, not angel of harm, is the role that inmates seek for the doctor. They want help, not harm, from a doctor. Palliative care from a doctor to prevent unnecessary suffering prior to a person being injected with lethal injection drugs, which can cause excruciating pain, is not unprofessional or unethical. Of course, these positions conflict with the American Medical Association's stance on the matter, which can be summed up as follows, quote, "While physician participation may potentially add some degree of humaneness to the execution of an individual, it does not outweigh the greater harm of causing death to the individual." Indeed, in 2006, when a surge of court cases and resulting media attention began to focus on botched lethal injection executions, the president of the American Society of Anesthesiology reacted defensively. And this is his quote. Lethal injection was not anesthesiology's idea, he insisted. Rather, the problem rested with, quote, American society, which, quote, decided to have capital punishment as part of our legal system and to carry it out with lethal injection. For these reasons, the legal system is, painted itself into a corner, and it's not the medical profession's obligation to get it out, end of quote. What the American Society of Anesthesiology's president's statement does not acknowledge, however, is that medicine is in the same corner with law holding the paint can and the brush. Recent litigation has revealed both new and longstanding positions of medical associations toward lethal injection. The American Medical Association, for example, has opposed physician participation in execution since 1980, expressing its view that, quote, a physician has, as a member of a profession dedicated to preserving life, when there is hope of doing so, should not be a participant in a legally authorized execution, end of quote. The AMA's position is particularly applicable to lethal injection because of the method's perceived affiliation with the medical profession. Whoops. Okay. Okay, sorry about that. I accidentally pressed something bad. Okay. As the Ethics Council of the AMA focused on a variety, of potential aspects of physician contributions encompassing the most basic symbolic role of being president of executions to more involved tasks such as monitoring vital signs. In other words, when physicians participate in an execution, it could be anything from just being there at the execution to actually monitoring vital signs. And we've since discovered actually being even more involved in that in ways that nobody knows about. The council also prohibited tasks that specifically pertain to lethal injection executions. In essence, the American Medical Association maintains that a physician's role in a lethal execution should be limited to certifying death after others have pronounced or declared the inmate dead. The implication then is that in many state statutes and lethal injection protocols are unethical. However, because the council's guidelines are not legally enforceable, it's difficult to assess how much weight they actually carry. Most physicians in the United States, including most anesthesiologists, are not members of the American Medical Association. Likewise, it doesn't appear that any medical association, including the American Medical Association, has ever disciplined a physician for participating in a lethal injection execution. It may therefore be difficult for medical associations to convince states to take seriously their perceptions of lethal injection. What happened in North Carolina appears to be an example of that. In other words, the state said physicians can in fact participate. Now, the AMA's stance might also not be particularly realistic. Recent revelations show that the extent of physician participation in executions has been underestimated. Likewise, my own surveys of lethal injection statutes and protocols have conceded a certain level of physician participation. I did two surveys, nationwide surveys, in 2001 and 2005 of lethal injection protocols. So the American Medical Associations may therefore reject the reflect the ideology of a bygone era that preceded discovery of the wide-ranging hazards of lethal injection executions. Medical associations were also generally apathetic about lethal injections problems and the physicians who were involved with them. For example, in 1994, Physicians and human rights organizations released a report entitled Breach of Trust, detailing the extent of physician participation in executions in the United States and the ethical questions invoked. The report was in response to a discovery that in 1990, there were several physicians who were involved in lethal executions in Illinois. After revealing that physician participation was widespread, the breach report cataloged the many perils of these physicians' disregard for the ethical and professional codes that prohibited such involvement. The report points out that executions are not medical procedures, and states may lure physicians into participating in execution procedures by promoting the illusion of, quote, humane, sterile, or painless executions. Furthermore, as the report said, physician participation undermines society's belief that physicians will, quote, work for the benefit of their patients and public. Finally, physician participation offers executions, quote, a degree of medical legitimacy and places doctors in the servitude of the state. Indeed, in 2007, a survey of the a 2007 issue of the Mayo Clinic proceedings further debated the topic of physician participation. According to one view, the legal system's ever-increasing reliance on physical, genetic, and psychiatric evidence in punishment cases turns physicians from the traditional role of healer into disinterested experts whose next utterance may seal the fate of the accused. In their view, this path from expert witness to execution participant is not a small logical step, but rather a fall down a slippery slope. Finding that the potential harm to many exceeds the possible benefits to few, they propose that physicians and their drugs should be physically, philosophically, and symbolically removed from the execution suites and replaced instead by personnel and tools that are clearly representative of the legal system and clearly distinguished from representing medical care. Another view, though, that's of David Wazell at Harvard Medical School, argues in favor of physician participation and submits that, quote, there is no reason to believe that physician participation in capital punishment would lead to a radical restructuring of society and society's views in which medicalized killing would be viewed as a therapeutic imperative, such as was the case in Nazi Germany. In response to the argument that physician participation casts physicians as, quote, tools of the government, well, Dr. Wazell submits that it would be equally legitimate to view the physician as a tool of the individual to minimize suffering and further the individual's goals, so long as the physician would not be willing to conduct the execution in a humane manner. Finally, with respect to the public trust, Dr. Wazell argues that physicians have historically participated in events that have challenged the public trust, and, quote, organized medicine has weathered these events. These events include shocking episodes in history, such as the Tuskegee experiments, along with currently accepted, but for some controversial procedures in the medical community, such as forced intake of medications or even abortions. These and other issues related to physician participation appeared to play a significant role in the oral arguments in Bayes v. Rees, either directly or indirectly, and such as what drugs were being used, what could go wrong, what could best prevent errors, et cetera, what qualifications are needed, how would one errors be presented. And as one argument mentioned, the state can't have it both ways with respect to the issue of participation of medically trained personnel. On the one hand, they can't say that we can have qualified, medically able personnel participating in this process, and that's our guarantee of its efficiency and or efficacy. And the other, on the other hand, say a requirement of having trained qualified personnel participate is impossible. The respondents, meanwhile, submitted that a phlebotomist, a person who specializes in IV insertion, but is not an MD, is an ideal monitor and is who the state of Kentucky actually uses for executions. So you had this kind of debate taking in going into a level of deep detail that I won't go into now, except to say that, you know, it was actually pretty cool because I was, you know, there for oral arguments at Bays v. Rees to see the justices actually go into a lot of detail with these medical concepts. It's just too bad that they didn't know more than they seem to think they knew. So in my mind, decisions concerning whether physicians or other medical personnel should be involved in lethal injection executions can't really be answered until the serious problems with lethal injection secrecy are solved. So I decline to, you know, sort of join this debate blindly in the search for solutions without complete knowledge or an understanding of the problems. And I think nor should legislatures and courts engage in that kind of debate. Not only that, you know, at the same time, I just wanted to point out that despite the Supreme Court's decision in 2008, things have really gotten worse after Bays. And I'll just run through these very quickly, and then I'll be at the end. Lethal injections, there have been some of the worst lethal injections we've ever had in this country in 2009. There were two executions in Ohio that lasted over 2 hours. There was one execution in 2009, that of Romel Broom, that never was completed. It lasted over 2 hours. It was certain that the executioners couldn't kill him, and the execution had to stop. That had not happened in this country since one other case, and that was an electrocution case in 1946. Depletion of sodium thiopental. We've run out of it, as you may have read in recent reports. States, as a result, have switched, switched to thiopental only without using all three drugs, now have major problems because they can't find the drug. Some states now have switched to phenobarbital as a result of that. Oklahoma and now Ohio have had executions involving pentobarbital because sodium thiopental is not around. Some states have switched to pentobarbital only. This has all occurred within the last 2 years, and most of it within the last 6 months, all these changes. A number of states we're seeing have imported drugs, or try to, a number of imports from a driving school that had a pharmacy in a driving school in London. Some imports, such as the state of Nebraska, from India, going all over the world trying to find these drugs, including a Danish manufacturer. Unapproved sources of the drugs coming from all these different countries because they're not FDA approved, Federal Drug Administration approved. International outrage over this because we're searching the world for these drugs. Federal involvement, states want the feds to give them their thiopental, the costs that are associated with this, the desperate measures to get drugs, and have executions as a result of this become a joke simply because there's such difficulty in getting these drugs. And in this respect, I leave you just nearly to the end to the Colbert Report. Everything he says is true, except for what he says about China. But everything he says is true, factually true in his commentary. Okay.
Here.
State of California was all set to carry out its
first execution in 5 years when they discovered their supply of the lethal drug sodium thiopental had expired on October 1st. Evidently, the bottle had passed its kill-by date. Things only got worse when they found out there was a nationwide shortage of sodium thiopental. I assume China bought it all to put in our toothpaste. After frantically looking through their cupboards and couch cushions and coming up empty, California had to look elsewhere.
California prison officials tried for 2 months to find the rare lethal drug that used to carry out the state's first execution in 5 years. New doctors show officials scoured the globe from Pakistan to London for the drug.
Right through the first tour of Europe and Asia looking for drugs that did not find any. As it turns out, England did have sodium thiopental, but the shipment was stopped at the border for inspection by the Food and Drug Administration. Which is understandable. There are lives at stake here. If there's something wrong with that drug, somebody could not die. Luckily, just when it seemed like this story of state-sponsored execution wouldn't have a happy ending, California got help from right next door. Arizona agreed to lend California a cup of death. Nation, it's these kind of stories of neighbors helping neighbors that really fill your heart with joy. Or if you're on death row, 12 grams of sodium thiopental. And don't think that act of charity went unappreciated. California Department of Corrections Undersecretary Scott Kernan went out of his way to send a thank you email writing, and I quote, "You guys in Arizona are lifesavers." So bravo, Arizona. You've proven that through teamwork, we can build a bridge together to the 21st century and then hang someone from it.
I think that sums things up. Thank you.
Okay, good evening, everybody. That was a wonderful presentation and very interesting, and it's an honor for me to be here with Professor Deno, and I thank the Bioethics Society of YU and Stern for inviting me. What I'd like to do is really give a halachic perspective, which is shadowed by my perspective as a physician, to this entire question. And I'm going to phrase the question a little bit more broadly in terms of the death penalty itself, and then the specific types of ways that we can accomplish, if that's the right word, the objective of killing the person that is supposed to be executed. So first let's look at the broader issue. How does the Torah view? And everything that I'm going to say is hopefully going to be accurate reflection of what the Torah says, and not what secular ethics may say, what medical societies may say, what the legal profession may say, because after all, those aren't divine, and they can be wrong. Whereas what our Holy Torah says, by definition, is correct, and the only way it can get messed up is if I misrepresent it or say it incorrectly. So I therefore take all the blame for anything that I may end up saying wrong, but the Torah's concepts are divine. By definition, something that is divine is right, it's perfect. And therefore, the natural opposition that many people have, good people, ethical people, religious people, towards the death penalty needs to be examined through the prism of the Torah. And what does the Torah tell us? The Torah provides arba misas beis din, the four ways in which an appropriately credentialed and authorized beis din has the right to take a person's life when they do certain actions that are found after a complete court process to be worthy or deemed to be appropriate that the Beis Din put that person to death. So anybody who says, I'm against the death penalty, is essentially saying, I don't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows better than I do. And that's an important position for us all to take and step back for a second and say that our natural inclinations sometimes aren't right. And everything that we say and do has to be seen through the eyes of God. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has said that the death penalty is appropriate, albeit under extremely specified situations. Another example of where a great Jewish leader got into trouble by seemingly taking his own stance against what God said was just read about in the Haftorah a few weeks ago. The tragic story. Very few tragic figures in our history as great as Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech was a fantastically great king. He was an individual that Chazal tell us had no skeletons in his closet. I don't want anybody checking my closet. Chazal says the reason he was so great was he had absolutely nothing wrong. He was literally head and shoulders above everybody else in his generation. He was greater than David HaMelech in many ways. The Gemara in Yuma has a whole discussion comparing David HaMelech and Shaul HaMelech. In fact, the only reason Shaul had a downfall was because he didn't wish to perform the death penalty on Agag. When we just had Purim, we know what happened because he didn't wish to perform the death penalty on Agag. Haman was born after a couple of generations, but directly because Shaul said, I will be more righteous than God, and I will be more merciful than God. And the Gemara's response is, Al tiyet tzadik harbe, do not be more righteous than God. If God says that something is appropriate, such as, for example, the death penalty that was supposed to be given to Amalek and Agag, so then we had, in those days, a requirement to follow that. And not following that is considered wrong and not merciful. And Shaul was punished. He lost his melucha, he lost his kingship, he lost his children. And Shaul is viewed as one of the most tragic figures in Tanakh because of that. On the other hand, let us not fall into the trap to think that we're a vengeful and a murderous people, Rachmana Litzlan, Chas V'Shalom, we're anything but that. We're the most humane of people. How do you reconcile that with a death penalty? So the answer to that is very simple. If you look in the Mishnah in Makos on Daf Zayin Omud Aleph, we have the famous description of how often Misas Beis Din was given. How frequently did we actually carry out the death penalty in our law? And the Mishnah states that if the death penalty was given more than once every 7 years, it was called the murderous Beis Din. Along comes the opinion of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, if I had been there, they wouldn't have killed somebody once in every 70 years. He would have done, the Gemara says, tremendous drishos v'chakiros. He would have done tremendous investigations into the witnesses. Gemara goes through some details. He would have asked the witnesses who were required to testify that they saw the entire crime. Circumstantial evidence is not good enough. The Gemara has a case where two people were ran into a cave, one of them a great rabbi, and a murderer, and there was a person found dead in the cave. The murderer came out with a dripping knife with blood on it, clearly having just murdered the victim. And the rabbi said, I can't give you the death penalty, even though I know you did it, because we didn't have appropriate evidence. Circumstantial evidence, no matter how strong, no matter how powerful, will never allow the death penalty to be provided by a Beis Din. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, if I had been around, I would have questioned the witnesses and found some discrepancy in their testimony. The murderer killed him under an apple tree. Exactly how much of a bud was there on the apple? Exactly what color were the buttons on his shirt? Exactly what slight discrepancy we can find between the two witnesses, and they would throw the witnesses out and they wouldn't have provided the death penalty. Once every 70 years would have been called the murderer's Beis Din. Along comes Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, and they said if we had been around at the time of the Sanhedrin, if we had been judges, never would we have provided the death penalty. We would have made sure that no person ever was executed by Beis Din. Because we have to make sure that we don't inappropriately kill or take a life. To that, the great Nasi Rav Shimon ben Gamliel responded, And Rav Shimon Gamliel said, if you had been around Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, you would have caused much death in the world. Granted, you might have stopped an execution from taking place by the Beis Din, but as a result of your stopping the Beis Din from taking appropriate legal action, you would have caused great death to occur in the world because the murderers would have had a field day. Knowing that there is no chance that they'll be executed for their crimes, they will run rampant. And you will actually increase the level of death that will occur in the world because of your, quote, mercy, inappropriate mercy. The Gemara doesn't come to a reconciliation as to which opinion is correct. All opinions are correct. One has to be extremely careful in halacha before one can think of actually giving a Misas Beis Din. Now, even when Misas Beis Din is appropriate, even under those rare circumstances where a person is convicted and the process is extremely difficult to go through, there is another very, very critical precept that we have to be aware of. And this is probably the single most well-known pasuk in all of the Torah. I would dare say that most secular Jews as well as non-Jews are familiar with the love your neighbor like yourself dictum that's written in the Torah of Yahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, which Rabbi Akiva said, Zeh Klal Gadol BaTorah. This is the great statement of all the Torah. Do unto others as you would like to do for yourself. You wouldn't want to be punched in the face? Don't punch somebody else in the face. You want to encroach on somebody's property? So don't encroach on their property. You wouldn't want them to encroach on your property? Don't encroach on their property. Do unto others as you would like done to yourself. The golden rule. What does that have to do with Misas Beis Din? So Chazal tell us a very important dictum in a number of places. Chazal tell us, Biror lo miso yofa. Pick for the convicted rotten scoundrel a pleasant, nice death. Where God says that the person is chayiv miso, and whether you go like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, wherever there is an appropriate, rare indication for the Beis Din to go and execute someone, it must be done. Baror lo miso yofa. It has to be done in a way that has been plagiarized by the Eighth Amendment of the United States. Cruel and inhuman punishment is not permitted. The Torah says that. The Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, brought down in the Gemara, forbids cruel and inhuman punishment. You must choose the least painful way within the parameters of the four types of death, Skila, Sreifa, Herig, V'chenek, that the Torah prescribes. You must do it in the most humane way. That's why the Torah says that the stoning, the Skila form of death, is not, as you might think, take a bunch of rocks and throw it at the person, but it's actually pushing the person off an attic or off a roof of a building that will guarantee, it's high enough that it will guarantee that the person will die instantaneously. That is a difficult thing for us to understand in terms of pushing somebody off a building. But in terms of the Torah's describing that we must do it in the most humane fashion, the technology that was available at that time, certainly that was an instantaneous or as close to instantaneous form of death as one could have within the framework of Skila. And therefore, the Gemara has an unbelievable discussion. The difference between if there would be an execution of a man or a woman in terms of whether they should be clothed or not during the execution. Because wearing the clothes would somehow provide some sort of a barrier to the instantaneous death, as flimsy as the clothing may be, or as little of a prevention against hurting yourself the clothing may provide, it would provide something. So therefore, the Torah says that a man is executed without his clothing on, because that will cause his death to be slightly less painful and slightly faster. Whereas the death for a woman is while she's clothed. Why is that? Does the Torah want to inflict pain upon women? Chas v'shalom. But the Torah knew that a woman would be more embarrassed if she was unclothed. And the Torah calculated that it is better that she suffer slight more physical pain than make her go through the mental anguish that would be greater for her if she was executed in a fashion that left her without her clothing. The tremendous sensitivity that the Torah has in Bror lo miso yofel, when that rare situation has to be that a person is given capital punishment. And as wicked and rotten a person as that is, who got capital punishment? The worst possible transgressors who did it openly. In order to provide somebody with capital punishment, they had to be warned immediately before the act. Imagine this. You have the person about to shoot somebody else in cold blood. The tragical, tragical events of Itamar. Imagine if there had been two witnesses watching what happened there two Shabbosim ago, Rachmana Litzlan. The two witnesses would have had to tell the terrorist, you're not allowed to do that. The Torah prohibits you from doing that. And if he kills them without acknowledging the witnesses, he's not given capital punishment. But if he says, yes, I know the Torah says that you're not allowed to do that, and I'm going to do it anyway, and then within a short period of time does it, only then is that considered an adequate hasra, an adequate warning. Tell me how you can imagine how often a killing Beis Din could possibly give misas Beis Din under those very strict requirements. So Bror lo miso yofel is an extremely important concept. When capital punishment is allowed with a Beis Din, it must be done in the most humane way. That's halacha psuka. That's an absolute requirement. What's the deal for today? We don't have a Beis Din. We no longer have the right to have judicial courts providing capital punishment. We hope and pray, b'mehreh b'yameinu Mashiach comes, we go back to the old days. We have all the rules and regulations of Jewish courts as we once did. We say it every day in Shemoneh Esrei. Ha'shiva shavteinu karisho na. We ask for that every day. We want this. It's a good thing. The judicial system was extremely fair. It was a system that was divine. We don't have that today. So what is the role, if any, of capital punishment according to Jewish law today? So there's a very interesting discussion in the secular journals, in the legal system, the medical system. Professor Deno so accurately described that I'm not going to add much to that description. I'll point out a couple of interesting facts that were alluded to but not explicitly mentioned. What percentage of lethal injections in the United States, or executions in general, because there are, I believe Nebraska still is the only state in the United States that has execution by the electric chair. I think all the other states do it via lethal injection. At least that's according to a Mayo Clinic article in 2008. I didn't Google or check to see if that's still true. But what is the likelihood, statistically speaking, of an electrocution, of a lethal injection, of a hanging, in the last couple of years, getting botched? So in a statistic presented in the Mayo Clinic proceedings, the statistic that is given is that of the roughly 900 lethal injections that have occurred since 1977 in the United States, 40 have been botched. That comes to almost 5%. Between 4 and 5%. That's a phenomenal statistic. You always somehow think that it's extremely clinical and accurate and simple method to go and kill a patient, kill a criminal. It's not so. Almost 5% of such lethal injections are botched. Does that fit the halachic parameter of Bror lo miso yofel? So I would clearly suggest it does not. If 5% of the skila, 5% of the sreifa didn't work out well, so then Chazal would have looked for a different methodology. It would not have been a successful Mises based in, if you knew that that percentage of people, unfortunately, were not killed in a humane and quick and relatively painless fashion. So that's a very important halachic point in regards to lethal injection. But I would leave that alone for a second, because it certainly is possible to more humanely than has been shown in the last 30 years in terms of lethal injections, execute a patient that the United States government or a state government says meets the requirements for execution. Having gone through a fair trial and court process with all of the appeals, the United States follows the very, very important rules of Dina d'Malchus or Dina, follows the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, which is a requirement for a non-Jewish country, a non-Jewish nation, to set up a fair court system. Jewish heaven is not going to be made up only of Jews. Jewish heaven has plenty of room for good people of any stripe. And of the seven mitzvahs that a non-Jewish person has to perform, one of them is to set up a just legal system. Zayin mitzvahs b'nei Noach include capital punishment. And a non-Jewish court has the halachic right to do fair and just capital punishment. So again, the automatic assumption that many people have that capital punishment is against the Jewish religion is simply incorrect. Jewish religion allows capital punishment for Jewish courts, and the Jewish religion allows capital punishment for non-Jewish courts. The question is, it has to still follow the parameters of Bror Lo Misa Yofa. It has to be done in as humane a way as possible. Now, if you go and look at the arguments that are made in secular and mostly medical societies against capital punishment, none of them really hold halachic water. And one can even argue, as Professor Deno brought down the paper by Dr. Wiesel, which is, I have a copy of it here, which was published in also the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And Dr. Wiesel, who's an anesthesiologist at Boston Children's Hospital, argues that we should view the convicted person on death row as a patient. And that that argument, therefore, should be that that patient should be treated in a humane and appropriate fashion. Granted, he's going to be killed. However, up until the point where he is killed, one needs to view him as a patient and needs to be taken care of properly. I don't think Halacha has any argument with that. I think Halacha would agree with that, that he needs to be treated in the most painless and the most humane fashion, even though you're going to kill him. So on that point, I think Dr. Wiesel is perfectly right. And one can argue that the official position of the American Medical Association, which, by the way, has absolutely no legal or moral standing, to my knowledge, and no physician is required to become part of that organization. Many physicians are quite against that organization. That organization certainly has no standing in the medical world on any clinical subject. It is a group of physicians that have banded together and agree or disagree on many, many things, but it certainly cannot speak for the medical profession, although it does. But it doesn't have the right, certainly, to speak for the halachic medical profession. And the statement that the American Medical Association makes, some of which Professor Denner also quoted, and I'll quote to you as well, says, "The image of physician as executioner under circumstances mimicking medical care risks the general trust of the public." That's a very nice statement, but it has no basis in halacha. Halacha would not necessarily agree or disagree with that statement. Halacha would insist that the patient be provided, the person who's going to be executed, be provided with the most humane death that you possibly can. How you go about doing that isn't prescribed by the Torah, because the Torah doesn't prescribe lethal injection. So how does the Torah view today any sort of secular killing of a patient? So I want to introduce you to a fantastic body of literature the Chazal have, which will shock you if you're not familiar with this. And I want to start off by quoting to you the Rosh. The Rosh, the Rabbeinu Osher, is one of the foremost halachic codifiers of Jewish law. He lived at the end of the 14th century. And the Rosh writes, and I quote, I'll first read it in Hebrew, and then I'll translate. The Rosh writes, well, first let me give you the background over here. The Rosh, when he moved to Spain, he was astonished to see that the local government had given the local Jewish government permission to do capital punishment. And in fact, the local Jewish government did capital punishment when it was appropriate. Not Mises Beis Din, as he's quick to point out, but did capital punishment under the jurisdiction of the government that handed over that authority to the local Jewish courts. And the Rosh is shocked at this. He says, Tomiani, I'm amazed that we're giving capital punishment. He moved to Spain, and all of a sudden he's back living 1,500 years earlier when they're giving capital punishment. And he writes, this is not necessarily good, not necessarily bad. He writes, Kama domim hayu nishpachim yoser im hoyadonim ayidei nochum. He said, if we left it up to the secular, non-Jewish courts to give capital punishment, how much more blood would be flowing? They aren't going to be as zealous and as careful in carrying out Mises Beis Din as we are. And therefore, hinachti lohem kiminogim. I'm not going to say no, they can't do it. He was shocked by it. I'm not going to answer it. I'm not going to say you can't do it. Avol, I don't have in my heart, however, to do it. And I'm not agreeing to it. I'm just not stopping them from doing it. That's what the great Rosh said 700 years ago. Now, his son, Rav Yehuda ben HaRosh, wrote the Sefer Zichron Yehuda, and he writes in it a number of very interesting things as well. And he writes as follows. Dovo Yodua, it's a well-known fact. Min hayomesh agolso sanhedrin milishkas agozis, from the time 40 years before the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, the Sanhedrin was exiled away from the Lishkas Agozis, from its home in the Beis Hamikdash. Meher Yameinu should be rebuilt. Bat Mutinani Foshus Misrael. We lost the authority to give capital punishment through official Mises based in methodology. However, we still see that it's being done. How? How can a secular court, and how could a Jewish court, give Mises Beis Din? And he writes, and this is a critical, important factor, and it would explain halachically why the United States government is allowed, albeit not required, is allowed to have death penalty laws on its books. And he writes, Kol ma shehadin ato hu ligdar pirtzes hador. Anybody who's giving capital punishment today, Jewish, non-Jewish court, is doing so to shore up the breaches in society. Because you have murderers running rampant, you have terrorists running rampant, you have all sorts of horrible things going on, and you have no way to prevent them. The deterrent factor is a halachic principle. And he says, therefore, Baruch Hashem, look at the language he uses, Baruch Hashem, thank God, Asher Nosan Kazos Belev Malchaya Oretz, we thank the local government, we thank God, and thank the local government, Loses Koach Li Yisrael Lodun, to give us the power to do capital punishment. This is in the 1500s. Ulivar Ose Risha, and to eradicate evildoers. Lule Zev, if it wasn't for this, Loyer Kaim Li Yisrael Beretz Zos. The Jewish people wouldn't be able to survive if it wasn't this deterrent factor. And then he adds, "Hadinim she'anudonim b'dinim nefashos einon kulam apia Torah." And we do not follow Torah rules when we do give out Mises Beis Din today. It's not called Mises Beis Din. It's called Ligdor Milsa. It's called setting up roadblocks against evil. It's called, we have no choice. And we have to make sure that we're preventing people from doing terrible, evil things. He writes in a later tshuva, He writes as follows. I'll give you examples of this principle, he says, from the Gemara. You have a famous story in the Gemara. A person was pining away for a woman. Young man fell in love with a young woman. Only one problem. She was married. Fell in love with her. The doctors of the time, I don't take any solace in the fact that the doctors probably didn't know what they were talking about at that time. Not that they know that much always today. The doctors at that time stated that if he doesn't have relations with this woman, he will die. Oh, pikuach nefashos! They stated that as a fact. Accept that as a fact. They went to the rabbis and said, what are we allowed to do? He's going to die if he doesn't have relations with this married woman. The rabbi said, let him die. Came back to the doctors, get a second opinion. All right, doesn't have any relations. Let him just see her unclothed. Came back to the rabbis, let him die. Got a third opinion from the doctors. All right, let her just talk to the guy behind the mechitza. Came back to the rabbis, is that good enough? Come on, what's wrong with that? Let him die. Why? We shouldn't treat Jewish women like sex objects. Think when this was written, think about modern society, what goes on. I could have a whole schmooze about that. Don't treat women as pure sex objects. Let the guy die to make a point. Now, where is saying in Torah that the guy has to die to not talk to a lady through a mechitza? Doesn't say it anywhere. How did the rabbis have the right then to say die instead of doing something that on the surface the Torah says is permissible? So he writes, this is exactly the example, lo yu benos yisrael prutzos barais. The Jewish women shouldn't be sex objects. Jewish women shouldn't be made into toys that a person can do whatever they want, whenever they want. He gives other examples. I'm running out of time. Famous story, a guy rode a horse on Shabbos. Not a nice activity. Not a capital crime. Rabbis killed him. How can they do that? It's not a capital crime. They had to set an example. People were running amok. People were breaking the rules. There was a disorder in society. You are sometimes allowed to break the rules for the greater good. Now, you and I can't do that, but the greatest sages of the time, in a based in format, do have that authority, which is almost rarely, if ever, used, but they have that authority. And the Gemara records such a case one time where it was done. It was a terrible time for the Jewish people. And in order to make sure that the Jewish people continued, they had to do something drastic, and they had halachic permission to do so. And there are other cases. And he concludes, Nasnu koach lebeizdin ligdor geder lutzorech hashor. Under extenuating circumstances, to prevent evil, to prevent murder in our society, Beisdin has the right, even nowadays, to go and do that when they have the authority to do so by the local governments. Or theoretically in Eretz Yisrael. How was Eichmann, Yamach Shemo V'Zichro, allowed to be killed? Or did they just not ask the rabbis? So the answer was, there would be a halachic permission to go and kill him under certain circumstances, which I'm not going to discuss right now, whether they did or did not meet those circumstances. And he writes, L'tzorech HaShoah, for a need of extenuating circumstances, Beisdin can do what they have to do. Bilvad, the understanding, tiyeh kavonosom, lirdof hatzedek via emes bilvad. There can't be any secondary gain. There can't be any negius to it. There can't be any personal agenda. It has to be totally for the seeking out of justice and righteousness. Halacha l'maisa, is this true or not? Is this the opinion just of the Rosh's son? So the Rivash contemporary concurs. The Rivash, he writes the same exact type of Lashon. He says, we have permission even though we don't practice Misas based in, we have the theoretical and occasional practical halacha l'maisa right to go and kill even nowadays through a proper Beis Din process, through a formal judicial process, not a vigilante process, but through the formal Beis Din process, albeit it's not Misas Beis Din. And they have to, of course, do this with great diligence. I won't go through all the details of this, but they have to do it with great diligence. Finally, do we paskin this? Is this said in Shulchan Aruch? Am I making this stuff up? I'm quoting you a great sage, but that's not the majority opinion. So let's look in Shulchan Aruch. Where else would you look for these things? Halacha l'maisa, you look in Choshen Mishpat Simen Beis. And I quote, Makin v'onshin l'tzorech shah. Beis Din has the judicial right, the halachic right, to punish, to hit, for tzorech shah, extenuating circumstances. What does the code say? Kol Beis Din, every appropriate credential, proper Beis Din. Not you and me. Afilu einam smuchin b'Eretz Yisrael, even though we don't have halachic smicha today. Nobody has smicha. My title of rabbi is not smicha, sorry. Nobody has smicha today. Nobody's a properly, fully ordained Beis Din. So nobody today can give Misas Beis Din, but we still have a judicial system. And we have the title rabbi. So appropriate rabbinical court, as defined by appropriate rabbinical court today, even outside of Eretz Yisrael, afilu b'chutz l'aretz. Imroim sha'am prutzim, if they see that there is immorality, if they see that there is a total disregard of normal societal mores, then Beis Din has the halachic power, dunin, they have the right to judge such people, bein misa, to kill them as appropriate, even if it doesn't follow what the Torah prescribes as misas Beis Din, doesn't meet the Torah criteria to kill the person. Beis Din has extrajudicial, superjudicial powers. Certainly monetary powers to take away. Any other type of powers. They have the right to physically beat somebody if that's the only way to prevent a pedophile or a horrible rapist or a horrible murderer. They have the halachic right to go and kill that person. Or to punish him in any way that they see fit. Through the normal extrajudicial, that's an oxymoron, process. And this is the Bechaber Paskins this, and the Ramah says, V'chein Noakin. And so we do. He brings down an opinion that disagrees. He says, this is halacha l'maisa. Bottom line is, can a Jewish doctor go and assist with a lethal injection, or could he assist with pulling the switch on the electric chair or any other form of humane murder? The answer is, I don't think that there is a halachic objection to him participating in a fair and just criminal system, such as this Medina Shel Chesed, this wonderful country, the United States, that has a very fine judicial system, and where a person has gone through the appropriate process and is declared to be found guilty of death and get the death penalty, I can't find to you any halachic reason why a Jewish doctor or a Jewish person would not be allowed to be the one to carry out the order of the court. But the bottom line question is this a nice profession for a nice Jewish boy or girl? And the answer to that is, I don't think so. And I'll quote to you my last quote from the Rambam. And the Rambam says, and I quote, Yoser Tov Yoser Roy, it is certainly more good, more worthwhile, Lepater Elef Chotim, to let 1,000 sinners and murderers or other Rishayim go scot-free, Milaharog Nokiecha, that to kill one innocent person. And unless you can guarantee absolutely that you're killing an appropriate person, if you're not 1,000% sure, and anybody that goes through the annals of recent court cases where convicted murderers who were executed were then subsequently post their execution found that maybe it wasn't so 100% certain, that should put a little bit of humility and humbleness in our in our hearts, and maybe we should be following what Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon said, I wouldn't be so quick to execute somebody, even though I have the halachic right to do so. Don't be so brash and bold. Now, this is different than killing somebody who's about to kill you. That's not a discussion that I've encountered tonight. If somebody's coming to kill you, you're mechuyev to kill him. The terrorist is coming at you, don't say, well, maybe he's not a real terrorist, he looks like he's a nice terrorist. You have an absolute obligation to kill him. The rules of war are also different than the rules of non-war time. It's a whole separate discussion. But here we're talking about, could a physician participate in a lethal injection? Whilst technically, yes, I would say that that certainly isn't the profession that I think that a Jewish person should be going into. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them.
So I'll field the questions and you can direct them to whoever or both of our speakers. We'll start with you. Yeah.
The sources you quoted, the numerous sources, are all dealing with if Beis Din has decided that the person is needs to be put to death. And then at the end you said that if the secular court decides, then a Jewish person could go ahead and put the person to death. So where's that jump from the Beis Din to the secular court?
The secular court functions through the same authority that the Beis Din functions today. And that they have an obligation to have a secular court. The United States government, if it wishes to fulfill and be a good standing non-Jewish person, has an obligation to set up a just judicial system. That's one of the Zionists has been in Noah. And they've done a fantastic job of that. They get an A+ in God's book, I think. And therefore, that judicial system is allowed to give out punishments that it sees fit and appropriate. Now, if it says we're going to kill black people, we're not going to kill white people, if we're going to kill Jewish people or non-Jewish people, then that wouldn't be a just system, and then they would be guilty of having a violation of the Zionist system they know of. But as long as the system is fair, it doesn't mean that it's perfect. As long as the system is fair, and they're saying the United States justice system is an extremely fair system. You may not like parts of it, you may not agree with parts of it, but it's fair. Fair doesn't mean that it's 100% what I want to do, but it's a fair system. So therefore, they have the halachic right to go and give capital punishment. And Beis Din, when it has such authority, I'm not suggesting, I hope nobody should qualify that. No Beis Din in New York can go give capital punishment. When the government says, the 8th District Court says, we're busy, we're going to turn it over to the RCA Beis Din to adjudicate all these cases, and, whatever you do is fine. So then the RCA Beis Din would have the right to go and adjudicate capital crime, at least in theory. But with the absence of having the secular government giving them that authority, then you're not allowed to go against the secular government. The secular government says you're not allowed to kill. So therefore, even if you did it in a fair and just manner, a local Jewish court would be absolutely forbidden to go and kill without that secular authority.
Yes.
Two questions. One for Dr. Neno and one for Dr. Rabbi Dabulet. First thing is Dr. Deno. In regards to alternative to Theopendel, why not you just regular anesthesia, and then why is there so much, I may have misunderstood, but why do we have to use Theopendel? Why can it not be anything else that regular hospitals use?
Normal general anesthesia, if you're worried about not talking about entirely.
Right, but are there not alternatives just use regular anesthesia that's used in hospital?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a great question. The question was, why not use some other kind of anesthesia than sodium thiopental or something else? I mean, that's the $5,000 question. It's because states don't like to change their methods of execution. It just takes a long time. They're entrenched in what has happened in the past. And once you start changing these methods, you're conceding that what you had in the past was problematic, number one. And number two is prison officials often simply don't have the sophistication to make those kinds of changes. We've now found that there are doctors who have been sort of undercover experts, but to acknowledge that you've been doing something wrong is very difficult. And so you get this bizarre scenario where you have states keeping a method that has proven problematic for decades.
question for Rabbi. Why not? Rabbi was in jail. He's not clear and present danger to kill me. I mean, obviously he may have killed, but no one. He didn't go to anyone and say,
right. That's why I said I wasn't going to get into the discussion of whether that would have met the halachic criteria. The government shouldn't kill. Jewish law doesn't permit killing for vengeance. You're not allowed to go and kill somebody through a beis din because they're a person that we don't like and therefore we want to kill him. And he's deserving of death because he's a rotten, rotten person. That's not the way beis din normally function. At the same time, let's say somebody, basically doesn't have a statute of limitations. There is no concept of statute of limitations in halacha in that respect. There are some cases wrong with that in regards to murder. So if somebody murdered somebody when they're 18 years old, and now they're 78 years old, and they're the Rosh Yeshiva, they're the Gadol HaDor, and two witnesses come forward and say, we saw you kill so-and-so, and he did, and it's real. Basin is not allowed to say, listen, this guy's done 60 years of community service, he's the Gadol HaDor, he's the greatest person in the world. He's the most compassionate person in the world. He, by the way, at his side, he also cured cancer. And he's just the most wonderful person around. Basically has an obligation to kill him.
I'm saying, but I didn't personally.
Right. So we don't treat whether a person is from Misa's based on what their future is. Misa's based works on what their past is. Non-Misa's based is purely to prevent things from going forward in the future. If a person was a horrible terrorist, a terrible person, and now he's no longer a threat, he's an invalid, so Basin wouldn't be allowed to kill him in that situation. God would take care of him. But Basin wouldn't be allowed in that situation. But if he still can pick up a gun, then there may be a reason that Basin would say, this guy is a danger to society, and we're going to kill him.
If he's in jail.
So if there are, we have a concept in halacha as well, that you're allowed, even in the times of Basin, you'd be allowed to, the guy's supposed to get stoned. He's a big guy, and as about to push him, he beats up the two guys, the two witnesses that are pushing him, and starts running away. So if there's a sharp shooter in Beis Din, he's allowed to take out a gun and shoot the guy running away. I guess not Skila. So the Gemara says he has no choice but to kill him in another way. So if he's high in Misa's Beis Din, then he's going to get killed one way or the other. Beis Din has the authority to do that. If he's not high in Misa's Beis Din, Beis Din is just killing him because he's a danger to society, so they also have the right to kill him any way that they want, and then it's actually a
starting in back.
I was just wondering, Dr. Dana, you mentioned the idea of phlebotomists performing the lethal injections. Were you mentioning that as a possibility for the future or something that's happening right now or has happened?
Oh, it's happening right now, and it happens in Kentucky. I mean, that was part of the oral argument. I was running out of time at that point. But in Kentucky, their explanation is they don't use physicians, they use phlebotomists.
So if 5% of the lethal injections are botched, or around 5%, like you mentioned those cases in 2009, were those mostly the ones being done by phlebotomists or by physicians?
We don't know what was being done in 2009 in Ohio. They didn't reveal who was conducting those executions. For the most part, you don't know who's conducting an execution at all. And then I did, as I mentioned, I did two surveys. In 2001, when I did a nationwide survey of execution protocols, the great majority of people conducting executions who were responding to that surveys were prison volunteers, who could have been anybody, someone who's never even held a syringe or
so
even...
people that had no training at all.
Absolutely, that's right.
And if I could just add, put on my medical hat for a second. A phlebotomist, all that person does is find access, what we call venous access,
right,
to the patient,
right,
to the felon. The actual injection of the drug, the phlebotomist is no more or less qualified than any other non-medical personnel. Phlebotomist is a trained technician that may be much more expert than a physician in putting this in a line, depending on the type of line, from experience. I have phlebotomists in the hospital that put in 10, 15, 20 IVs a day. I haven't put in an IV in a while. I'm a doctor, they're not. You want them to put in the line, not me. So the actual technical component to putting in a line is in almost all the time the hospital not done by a physician. And there's no need for a physician to do that. The questions that have been raised in terms of trying to kill the person who deserves to be killed in a humane fashion. We're not killing people because we hate them. We're killing people because they either broke a law or to prevent the crime from occurring again. So we should try to kill them in a humane fashion. We're not cruel because we killed somebody. That's the law. what we try to do is kill them in the most humane fashion. The argument is that an anesthesiologist using modern technology should be able to put the patient comfortably to sleep, and then the drugs or the toxins that we're giving them to kill them should be able to be done in an absolutely painless and humane fashion. That's the argument. Who should be doing that? Halacha doesn't have an opinion on that. The AMA does, other people do. You can argue it any way you want. Halacha would say kill the person in the most humane fashion that you can. If that's a board certified anesthesiologist versus a veterinarian versus a person who you train. That's the only thing he knows how to do, is inject via vent or some other toxin. So then that's the most humane way to do it. That's the way it should be done.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that that you know, in this litigation, that even though there was a phlebotomist, the claim was that, you know, these, and this is where Dr. Heath would be helpful, you know, what's done in a prison is very different than what's done in a hospital. In many cases, until relatively recently, the executioners couldn't even see the inmate. The inmate's in a separate room for the most part. So the executioners are in a side room, and the lines are going around, oftentimes leaking. That's been a problem where the drugs are leaking. And so if there's a problem with the inmate, they can't even see them. If the inmate's in pain or something like that, and many of these inmates are obese, or they're very muscular, or they have some sort of physiological problem. Many of them are drug users. So even if you're a phlebotomist who's used to doing this all the time, you may not be, you know, accustomed to this particular group of individuals. You can't see the person, and there are just numerous problems because this isn't a hospital kind of setting. In Kentucky, until relatively recently, you could inject in the neck. In a number of states, you can still inject in the groin and do a cut-down procedure. So it's just not like a hospital setting. And secondly, if I could, on the 5%, I know that was a quote by people who know far more about medical procedures than I do. But I just wanted to add that the pacuronium bromide is a paralytic procedure. I mean, it's a paralytic drug. And so if the inmate is paralyzed, which they are, the botch, you couldn't tell whether this is a botch procedure unless you're an educated anesthesiologist or someone who could see tearing or some kind of effect. So that 5% is based on cases where it's very apparent that the inmate is in pain or is in trouble. But in most states, nearly all states, if the thiopental is being injected, and immediately thereafter, there's the pancromonium, which is the paralytic agent. By that point, the inmate's paralyzed. So even if you wouldn't be able to tell whether there's a problem. So it looks peaceful, or again, you would know far more than I, but but if there was a problem and the inmate was suffocating and conscious, you wouldn't be able to tell. So the reason Dr. Heath got even involved in this is he was reading about one of the federal executions where there was a description that the inmate was tearing, even though this was Timothy McVeigh, even though he was paralyzed and not moving. So Dr. Heath, or an educated doctor, would be able to say that, you know, there might be some pain going on there because tearing typically doesn't occur, you know, unless there's some physiological reaction. But to untrained, you know, executioners, they wouldn't be able to know something.
One of the worst things that an anesthesiologist experiences, you should never have to experience that, is when a patient is paralyzed, but they're not under. They paralyze the patient, it's much easier to put a tube down their throat if they're paralyzed, otherwise they fight you, and it's more dangerous. But you first give them something that knocks them out. Now, not every drug, we don't want to say this too much, not every drug works exactly the same way on every patient. And you can have patients that are given what should be the, quote, adequate dose, who are not adequately sedated. And if you then paralyze them, they will have the same sensation as you would if I put my hands around your neck and started to choke you. You're gasping for breath. And that is the concern. And heaven forbid, if I should ever be needing capital punishment, I would certainly want somebody that knows what they're doing. Yeah, and I think that's the main way. Whether you believe in capital punishment or not is irrelevant. You know, that's not the discussion. The discussion is, if we're going to do that as a society, the law states that the government has the right to do that within that framework. It should be in a humane way. If the government were to decide that it doesn't wish to do that, that's perfectly fine according to halacha also. Halacha does not demand that a secular court give capital punishment. It allows it, but it doesn't demand it.
Take a couple more questions. Yeah.
What is the status of the Hippocratic Oath in America? Is there any legal binding to it? Is it a random thing that just has been tradition?
You wouldn't want to read the original Hippocratic Oath.
I read it.
It's actually a Hodeh Zarah.
Yeah.
It's probably forbidden for a Jewish person to take the Hippocratic Oath based upon what it was. I did not take the Hippocratic Oath. It can be revised. It is not a requirement of licensure. It's not a requirement for graduation. It is not a requirement for work, anything. It's a very nice way that it's been done. It's, you know, it's a nice sounding and very beautiful ritual for those to find those types of things important. It has no legal standing, and it's not a requirement. You can be a practicing physician never having taken the Hippocratic Oath. You need to have a license to practice in New York, but you do not need to have a Hippocratic Oath statement signed.
You mentioned that a Jew would not be allowed to take this risk of killing someone inhumanely. When it comes to a test, a Jew wouldn't be able to kill someone in a initially when you spoke about the statistic of 40 out of 900 people not dying from the injection, you mentioned that would not be a plausible statistic for you to feel comfortable giving someone this death. In terms of now dealing with doctor and life, when it comes to a test like the apnea test, where doctors know that every once in a while someone dies of cardiac arrest or something else caused by trying to take this apnea test before confirming that the patient is for sure dead, is that in any way then permissible for a Jew to perform?
If I understand you correctly, I'll restate the question just to make sure I understand it correctly. A physician is never allowed to do, under any circumstance, anything that will hasten a patient's death. That's the halacha. In Oregon, places in Europe, you can kill a patient. Literally. Nobody seems to be worried about that slippery slope. I'd be much more worried about that slippery slope than I would about a physician-assisted lethal injection. It's a separate discussion. No physician, certainly according to Jewish law, you are absolutely forbidden to do anything to hasten a patient's death. That does not mean that you must do everything possible to save the person. You just know how to do something to hasten the death. When you're doing an apnea test, you have to ask yourself why you're doing it. If you're doing it for a halachically valid reason, then you're allowed to do it. Just like you're allowed to take somebody's appendix out, you have a halachically valid reason you're trying to save his life. 0.001% of people will die during the appendectomy or because of the anesthesia or because of the reaction to the drug. How are you allowed to do it? 0.01% die because 99.9% will live and will save you their life. So halacha takes the risk-benefit into account. If there's only risk and there's no benefit, then halacha forbids you to do that test.
Would there be anyone that would argue with that?
I have no doubt, but I can't understand what they would argue about. You're not allowed to do something. First of all, the person's a ghost, you're not allowed to touch them. So I don't know how you go and do a test on a person that you're not allowed to touch. So assuming you can do the test, halacha doesn't permit you to touch a ghost. That's not a well-known fact. It's also to touch a ghost. Now do anything to hasten their death. You're not doing anything to help them live. You can't do anything to hasten their death. And therefore, if you're doing something that has no medical purpose for that patient, you're not allowed to do that test, as far as I understand.
And has there been any feedback in the legal field in terms of performing a procedure on a patient with no potential patient benefit for the patients themselves, with risk for the patient? Is there anything that's coming outside the Jewish world?
American law, I don't want a hospital in front of an American lawyer, but you in the hospital can pretty much do almost anything that's not illegal between you and the patient. If the patient says, I don't mind being part of this experimental trial, even though I get no benefit from it, they sign all the right informed consent forms, you're allowed to do it. Halacha might not allow you to do that. But a patient is allowed to say, I'm willing to have you experiment on me in a way that passes internal review board. Talking about a valid scientific study that's approved by the IRB. So halacha might not allow you to do that, but secular law would allow you to do that potentially.
On the other hand, I thought you meant, and I might be wrong on this, that perform a procedure once you've started another. So for example, if you're operating and you see that there's something else wrong with the person while you're operating and they haven't given their informed consent,
then that would could create a problem if you go beyond what they have consented to.
Unless it's an emergency type of a finding, right? If you told the patient you're only going to take out the gallbladder, and then you find something that would require you in a non-emergent setting. Well, I also found something else. I didn't tell them about it. You could run into trouble. But if it's anything dealing with complication, that's what the theoretically informed consent is supposed to take into account, every single complication that can occur, which of course it doesn't.
All right, I think that's it for now. I'd like to thank Dr. Deborah Denno and Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt. Wonderful presentation tonight. Thank you all for coming. There's still some more food.